Chapter 18. Lara doesn't search for the veil, doesn't grab at air. She simply lifts one hand and slashes it sideways, a single decisive motion, and the veil parts around her, around us. I step forward, feel that familiar bloom of cold, and then we're through. We're still in the park at the base of the castle, a bleaker version of it. The world is now gray and ghostly. I half expected Jacob to stay behind, but he's here at my side. He lets out a shivery breath and folds his arms. "Skull and bone," he murmurs, and I don't know if he's talking to me or to himself. Lara brushes invisible dust from her sleeves, that warm light shining in her chest. Nearby, a man bundled in winter clothes calls out a name. His voice is high and thin, as if the wind is stealing it away. It's beginning to snow. Not everywhere, just right around him. When he turns and makes his shuffling way out of the park, the veil seems to recede with him like a tide, taking the winter with it.
"How?" I start.
"The in-between isn't really one place," explains Lara. "It's different for every ghost, a kind of time capsule. Ghosts overlap sometimes, bleed together, but in the end, each ghost is living in their own in-between, moving through their own loop." We follow the man out of the park and down the road. He trudges through shallow snowdrifts up to the door of a house. He shoulders the door open and steps inside. Lara quickens her pace and we catch up before the door falls shut. Lara, Jacob, and I step out of the falling snow and into a home. Jacob puts himself in front of me like a shield. But the man doesn't turn toward us. He stands at a fireplace, stoking the wood of a dying fire with a long iron rod. He's tall and gaunt, with wild gray hair and deep-set eyes. He could be scary, but he's not. There's just this overwhelming sadness rippling off him like steam.
"Have you seen him?"
asks the man in a low, husky voice. I take a step forward. "Who?" I ask gently. Lara is already lifting her pendant, but I catch her wrist, shake my head.
"Wait,"
I whisper.
"Why?"
she whispers back.
"It isn't necessary to hear his story."
Maybe it's not necessary, but it feels important. The man's sad eyes drift toward me, to the camera around my neck.
"What do you have there, lass?"
I raise it for him to see. It takes photos. A shadow crosses the man's face and I start to think he doesn't know what a photo is. Maybe he lived before cameras existed. But then he draws a small, weathered piece of paper from his shirt and turns it for me to see. A boy stares out from the yellowed square of an old photograph.
"My son, Matthew," he explains, "got this taken at the winter fair, right before he went missing."
My stomach lurches. A child stolen in winter. The man's eyes go to the window.
"My wife, she went south to see her kin, but I couldn't leave my boy. I told his mother I'd wait. I'll wait as long as I have to."
The man sinks into his chair by the dying fire and closes his eyes.
"I'll wait until he comes home."
Wind whistles against the glass. The man's breath fogs the air and I shiver as the cold reaches me. I'll wait as long as I have to. I remember what Lara said about ghosts, that they only stay in the veil because they're stuck. My chest aches for this man trapped here. In this world, in this house, in this endless day of waiting, because I know he'll never stop looking out that window. And I know his son is never coming back.
"Cassidy,"
says Lara, appearing at my side. I realize that it's time.
"Do you have a mirror?"
she asks, offering her own. I nod down to the camera in my hands. "I have this," I say, snapping off the cap and showing her the front lens, the way it shines when I tilt it, reflecting pieces of the room. "Will it work?" She looks skeptical.
"I suppose we'll find out."
I look to Jacob, who's hanging back by the door, his face unreadable.
You're not like him, I think. You don't belong here. You belong with me.
Jacob bites his lip, but he nods, and I turn my attention back to the man in the chair. Frost is lacing his beard, and his skin is going white with cold.
If you see my boy,
he murmurs, his breath a cloud. I'll send him home, I promise, lifting the camera.
Can I take your picture to show him?
He drags his eyes open, meets his reflection in the lens, and goes still. It's like someone swapped him for a statue instead of a person. He freezes, all the pain and sadness gone from his face. I hear Jacob suck in a breath, but I keep my focus.
Do you remember the words?
Asks Lara.
I think I do.
Watch and listen, I say. Frost crawls over the window panes. See and know. Icicles trail down the man's face.
This is what you are,
I whisper. The man's edges soften, his whole shape rippling. Then I take a deep breath, gather up my nerve, and reach into his chest. I pull out a fragile thread, brittle and gray. Holding the man's life, his death in my hand, I understand what Lara meant when she talked about purpose. I understand what drew me again and again into the veil. What I was looking for without looking. What I needed. It was this. The ribbon crumbles in my palm, and so does the man. To ash, and then to nothing. Jacob and Lara and I stand together, silent in the narrow room. Jacob's the first to move. He comes forward and crouches at the foot of the chair, running his fingers through the last of the dust. And then the room around us begins to thin, like a photo worn by time, the details wiped away. Of course, the ghost is gone now. It makes sense that his veil is fading too. I feel Lara's hand on my shoulder.
We should go.
Once we're safely on the living side of things again, the three of us walk back to the lane's end. Jacob and Lara are a few steps ahead, Jacob peppering her with questions. They seem to be warming to each other, or at least reaching a sort of truce. I hang back. My hand is still prickling strangely from where I held the ribbon of the man's life. His death. It was sad, sending him on. But there was a kind of relief, too. Like letting out a breath you've been holding too long. Setting it free. And afterward, the tap, tap, tap was gone. Not just softer, but vanished. Leaving a stretch of quiet, of peace behind. It felt right. I quicken my pace to catch up with Jacob and Lara.
What's the scariest ghost you've ever faced?
Jacob is asking. Lara taps her finger to her lips.
Couldn't say. It's between William Burke.
The corpse robber turned serial killer?
Stammers Jacob.
That's the one. Says Lara. It's between him and this little girl in petticoats I found in one of the plague vaults.
Jacob snorts.
A tie between a mass murderer and a girl in a dress?
Lara shrugs.
Children give me the creeps.
Children? That reminds me. Lara, I say, quickening my step even more. Have you ever seen a woman in a red cloak? The humor bleeds from Lara's face. Her mouth drawn tight.
Are you talking about the Raven in Red?
I nod. Have you ever seen her?
Once, she says tightly. Last winter. I was visiting for the holidays, hunting in the in-between, when I heard her singing. And the next thing I knew, I was walking straight toward her outstretched hand.
Lara shakes her head.
It was a near thing.
But you got away.
I got lucky. Aunt Alice was nearby, I heard her calling, and it broke the spell. I had just enough sense to twist free and leave the in-between. And I've been very, very careful ever since.
Lara's dark eyes narrow.
Why? Have you seen her, Cassidy?
I nod, and Lara's hand shoots out, stopping me in my tracks.
You have to stay away from her. Do you understand? There's an urgency in her voice. It's wrong on her, out of place. Remember what I said about our lives. Her hand goes to her chest, to the place where the light shone through in the veil. About the ghosts who want them. The Raven is one of those. She feeds on the threads of the children she steals. But those threads are small and thin. She has to eat a lot of them just to be what she is. But if she got a hold of a life like yours or mine, something bright, it would be disastrous. I shudder at the thought. Lara looks to Jacob. Do your job, Ghost. Keep her safe.
Jacob snorts. Easier said than done.
We climb the hill that leads back to the lane's end. It doesn't make sense, Lara says, half to herself. It isn't the right time of year. I know. It's been bothering me, too. What was it Findlay said? She comes with the cold. I think of the river, my fall into the icy stream, the way the cold reaches for me every time I cross the veil, the bluish edge to the light in my chest. Maybe it has something to do with the way I... It's still hard to say out loud, even now, even with someone like Lara. I change course. What does the veil feel like when you step through it? I ask her. Lara thinks. Like a fog, a fever. I was ill once, really ill. It was touch and go for a bit, she adds briskly. And I couldn't stay awake. It feels like that, dreamy but not in a good way. I nod. For me, it feels like falling into a frozen river. It feels like bitter cold. If the Raven is drawn to cold, then maybe she's drawn to me. Maybe, says Lara. Well, that's even more reason to stay away from her. If you do see her, cover your ears, get out of the veil, and for goodness sake, she adds, nodding at my camera, get yourself a proper mirror. We're nearly back to the lane's end when I recognize the man ambling toward us, his crown of red hair catching the sun. I slam to a stop at the sight.
Uh-oh, says Jacob.
What have we here?
Says Findlay. He looks at Lara.
Miss Chaudhry, I never took you for a rule breaker.
Lara straightens. I haven't broken any rules, she says. Once again, the picture of primness. The wind has blown my brown curls all over the place. How is it her black braid is still perfectly in order? What are you doing here? I squeak at Findlay.
Funny thing, that, he says. Your parents sent me to check on you, only you weren't there.
I glance at Lara. I might have promised my parents I would stay inside, I tell her. I swivel back to Findlay. We were just getting some fresh air.
Is that so?
He says, a glimmer in his eye. I know that spark. I've seen it on Mom's face 100 times. I'm not in trouble, am I?
Ugh, he says amiably. A little wandering never hurt anyone.
Which I'm pretty sure isn't true, especially when it comes to young people and foreign cities full of child-snatching ghosts, but I appreciate the sentiment.
Tell you what.
He holds up a meaty finger.
I won't tell your folks on one condition.
What's that?
Well,
he says,
your mom and dad sent me to see if you were feeling brave enough to join them up at the castle.
I wasn't scared, I snap.
No shame in being scared,
he counters.
But there's a difference between being scared and being scared away. Come with, and I'll look like a right champion for changing your mind. You're welcome to come too, Miss Chaudhry.
I glance at Lara, who shrugs. I'll pass, she says. The castle is a fascinating sight, she adds with a weighted look. It flicks from me to Jacob and back. Just remember what I told you.
Or, says Jacob, we could just go back up to the nice warm place with comic books and tea cakes. Look now, says Findlay, seeing me hesitate. You can't come to Edinburgh and not see the castle. We can see it from here, says Jacob, pointing at the building on the cliff.
Aren't you just a wee bit curious?
Continues Findlay. Of course I'm curious. I've never been inside a castle. Plus, my head's full of Lara's talk about purpose, and my hands are still warm from sending on the man in the house.
Well,
prompts Findlay.
What do you say?
I look at Jacob. I want to see the castle, but I don't want to go without him, and not just because I might get stuck in the veil. It was weird, him not being there this morning. I felt like someone had cut my shadow away.
But Jacob's not just my shadow. He's my partner in crime.
The sidekick to my hero. Or hero to my sidekick, I amend when he looks at me aghast. And he should have a say. It's up to you, I think. If you don't want to go, we don't have to go. And maybe he just wanted to be given the choice, because he rolls his eyes and flashes me a grin.
Well,
he says,
I've read all the comics, and I can't eat the cakes.
I smile and turn to Findlay. All right, let's go to the castle. Chapter 19. Edinburgh Castle sits on its high rock cliff, looming over everything. As we start up the broad stone steps, it stares back at us, a dark gray shadow against a pale gray sky. As we climb, Findlay rambles about the castle's many famous ghosts. His eyes grow brighter with every story. There's the piper who went missing in the tunnels, and the soldiers lost during a siege, and a headless drummer, and the prisoners left in the vaults, and a woman accused of witchcraft and burned at the stake. The veil is growing heavier with every story, and with each upward step. The weight of history, of memories, of things no longer here, but not gone either. Findlay leads us over an empty moat and through the front gate onto the castle grounds. The word castle has always made me think of a giant house, but this is more like a miniature city. We're still outdoors, surrounded by high stone walls and a network of lower buildings, some steepled and others flat, all of it like something out of a medieval fantasy.
Cool,
whispers Jacob. The veil's gray curtain flutters at the edges of my sight. If I crossed over here, what would I see? Curiosity blooms inside my chest, but I know now that it's not just curiosity. It's the pull of purpose. My heart picks up, my fingers curl around the camera. I don't realize I've stopped walking until Findlay glances back.
This way,
he shouts. He leads us through what he calls a portcullis. It's a gate like the top half of a mouth full of sharp steel teeth. We go up and up and up, all the way to the top, to a courtyard ringed with cannons and studded with tourists. The producers clearly couldn't shut down a place this popular to film my parents.
I don't see them,
says Jacob. But Findlay is already beelining for the edge of the battlements. I don't know what he's looking at. Not until I get close enough to see the view beyond the stone wall. View doesn't do it justice. We're so high up with the castle buildings at our backs and the steep drop-off of the cliff. All of Edinburgh rolls away like a carpet beneath us.
Wow,
says Jacob. Wow, I echo.
See?
Says Findlay, beaming.
I told you it was worth the trip.
He's right. This place is breathtaking. For once, I can't bring myself to take a picture because I know a photo could never really capture what I'm seeing. So I lean on the ramparts and simply take it all in. The veil shudders and ripples, and I close my eyes, imagining I can hear the distant thud of soldiers' boots, the thunder of cannons, the mournful song of a bagpipe, and singing. I shiver. Do you hear that? I ask Jacob silently, but when he answers, he sounds distracted.
It's probably the wind.
But it's not the wind. Way up here, the air whistles around us, but there's more than air to that sound I heard. That voice. I know it by the way the music echoes in my bones. I try to remember Lara's words, her warnings, but my own thoughts keep unraveling, and I have to hold on tight just to keep them from floating away.
Cass?
Jacob waves a translucent hand in front of my face. I blink, and the singing fades, replaced by only the high, thin breeze. Maybe Jacob was right. Maybe it was just a trick of the air. I step away from the rampart just as something goes boom. I jump, lurching back, but it's clear I'm not the only one who heard that. A plume of smoke goes up nearby and the air shakes with the sound. Findlay only smiles.
1 o'clock cannon,
he says, as if it's perfectly normal for people to fire heavy artillery in the middle of the day.
Come on,
he adds.
We'd best go find your parents.
I pull the show's filming schedule from my pocket, but all it says is castle. Not incredibly helpful, considering this castle takes up a whole mountaintop. Do you have any idea where they are? I ask Findlay.
No,
he admits,
but it shouldn't be that hard to find them. I'm guessing the barracks or the prison cells.
Right, makes sense. My parents aren't here for the crown jewels or the kitchens or St. Margaret's Chapel, each site proudly advertised by a placard or sign. No, they'll be knee-deep in the darker part of the castle's history. We cut through the nearest building, which, according to the banner on the wall, is the Great Hall. My first thought is that it looks like the dining hall straight out of Harry Potter.
Pig warts, announces Jacob triumphantly. Broom ball, crow puff.
He's never actually read the books, which he knows drives me crazy. But he also knows I don't have time to sit and turn 10,000 pages for him. So I broke down and showed him the movies.
It's like that scene with Tumbledore and the Magic Hat,
he exclaims gleefully. He clearly wasn't paying that much attention. We make our way from the Great Hall out into another smaller courtyard. Here, the spell is broken by signs for public restrooms and a little touristy cafe.
Kinda kills the mood, doesn't it?
Says Jacob. Findlay stops to grab a paper cup of strong black tea. I look around, trying to figure out why the castle feels so different from Mary King's Close. Maybe it's the number of tourists or the open air. According to Findlay, this place is definitely haunted, and I can feel the veil. But it doesn't feel menacing. There's a low and steady tap, tap, tap of ghosts, but it's like a light drizzle, not a downpour. Is it just me, I think, or is this place way less scary than Mary King's Close?
Shh, hisses Jacob. Don't say that.
Why not?
You'll jinx us.
I roll my eyes. And then we step out of the courtyard and down into the prisons, and all that nice, not-so-haunted feeling goes away, sucked out like heat through an open window. I shiver, the air around me suddenly cold. The ceilings are low, the walls broken by iron bars, messages scrawled on the backs of cells like fingernails dug into wood. All the hairs on my arms stand up in warning. Jacob scowls at me.
You did this.
I didn't jinx us, I whisper out loud. The castle was already haunted.
Maybe,
he glowers,
but you definitely made it more haunted.
I want to tell him that's not how it works, but the veil is already wrapping itself around me, trying to drag me down, under. The tap, tap, tap turns to hammering. I retreat a few steps toward the safety of the courtyard. Then I hear Dad's voice, the one he uses when he's teaching a class.
We've moved from a buried town to a looming fortress. The Edinburgh Castle sits on a shelf of jagged stone, standing guard for nearly 1,400 years.
With that much history, chimes in Mom, it's no wonder the castle is home to so many ghosts. Of course, their voices aren't coming from the airy, ghost-free courtyard at our backs, but from down the hall, deeper within the prison. As if Findlay can tell I'm about to bolt, he plants a large hand on my back and urges me forward into the dark. We find my parents standing in a cell, the light from the camera crew casting jagged shadows through the bars. Prisoners of war were kept in these very cells, says Mom. And if you look closely, you can see their scrawled and desperate messages. Of course, these aren't the only things they left behind. I hear a dull knocking, like a fist against iron bars. No one else seems to notice. I grip my camera.
And cut, calls one of the crew.
Mom sees Findlay and then me, and her face breaks into a smile.
Cassidy! There's our girl, says Dad. Well done, Findlay, coaxing her out. Wasn't hard,
he says, shooting me a conspiratorial look.
I think she was getting restless.
You missed the South Bridge vaults, says Mom, wrapping an arm around my shoulders. I try to look disappointed, even though I'm just relieved. And I'm even more relieved when they wrap filming and we get out of the prisons. We head back into the open air of the courtyard. The crew heads for their next location, the castle barracks, but my steps slow. Not because I'm scared, but because there's music on the air again. High and sweet and haunting.
That's because there's a bagpiper, says Jacob.
And he's right. It's just a man in a kilt standing on the battlements above, the instrument wailing softly in his hands. There's nothing strange about the bagpiper. So why do I have such a strange feeling? Maybe I'm just borrowing trouble, as Mom would say, looking for monsters in the closet, shapes in the dark. I'm probably still on edge after what happened with the man in the house, shaken up by the whole sending ghosts on. It was pretty intense. Dad glances back from where he stands at a set of doors.
Cass, you coming?
I'll be right behind you, I say, nodding at a restroom sign. Jacob waits outside while I duck in. I snap the cap back on my camera lens and set it on the counter, splashing a little water on my face. My nerves settle, and I sigh, take up the camera again, and head back outside. But Jacob's not there. Jacob? I call for him, inside my head, and then out loud. Jacob? No answer. It's like he just disappeared. Only he wouldn't do that again, not after this morning.
Jacob?
I call again, louder. And then there's a lull in the bagpiper's song. Jacob's voice reaches me, but it's thin, wispy.
Cassidy.
I turn, scanning the courtyard. Where are you? Why can't I see him? Why does his voice sound so far away? And then it hits me. The veil. But why would he cross over without me? I'm coming, I think, reaching for the gray curtain.
Stay back,
he starts, but his voice cuts off suddenly, and I'm already tearing the fabric aside, tumbling out of one world and into another. Cold water and numb skin and all the air knocked out of me, and then I'm through. It takes my eyes a split second to adjust to the grayed out world and the light inside my chest, to the tourists suddenly replaced by soldier ghosts marching in the castle square, to the sight of Jacob's panicked face, visible for only an instant before he's dragged backward into the prisons. I don't think then. It never occurs to me to run away, to run any other direction except toward my best friend.
Jacob!
I shout, racing after him. Afterward, I will regret so much about this moment. The fact that I didn't have a plan. The fact that I didn't take the cap off my camera. The fact that I simply ran. But in this moment, all I can think of is saving Jacob. I plunge into the darkened prison. The cells aren't empty anymore. Men in ragged uniforms rattle the bars, but I'm not paying attention to any of them because Jacob's there, on the ground of a far cell, being pinned to the damp stone floor by a half dozen children. Two of them look like they belong in a fancy old painting, and one is dressed in rags. Others look more modern, like they could even go to my school. The only thing they have in common is the cold pallor of their skin and the fact that they're all attacking my friend. Hands clamp over Jacob's mouth and knees pin his wrists. One frost-covered boy sits on his chest as the other kids fight to hold him down.
Get off him,
I order, hurrying toward the cell. Jacob tears his mouth free long enough to shout, "Run!" But I can't. I won't, not without him. "Get away from my friend!" I snarl, lifting the camera. But the cap is still on, and before I can get it off, a hand catches my wrist, and a voice whispers in my ear. "Sorry, love," it says. "They only listen to me." The hand tightens and I'm wrenched around. For an instant, all I see is the red of her cloak. Then, glossy black curls, white skin, crimson lips that curl into a sweet smile. "Hello, dearest," coos the raven in red. I know I need to fight, but I can't. Not with her fingers on my skin and her eyes on my eyes and her voice like music in my head. "You," I murmur, but I can't even hold on to my thoughts. Her other hand drifts up to my chin, tilting my face toward hers. "So much light. So much warmth."
"Cassidy!"
screams Jacob, and I snap back to my senses, but it's too late. The raven in red changes before me. Her cloak whips violently, as if caught in a gust of wind, and her fingers harden like claws. Her smile cracks and turns cruel, and she thrusts her hand straight into my chest. Cold rushes through me, a bone-chilling cold, worse than the bottom of the river. It feels like icy fingers wrapped around my heart. I can't breathe, can't speak. Can't do anything but watch as the raven draws out her hand, clutching a ribbon of blue-white light. My light. My life. She tears it free, and everything goes dark. Part 4. The Raven in Red. Chapter 20.
"Cass? Cassidy? Oh God, Cassidy, wake up!"
I open my eyes and see gray. It takes me a second to remember where I am, another to realize I'm lying on my back. I stare up at the dim, slick stones of the prison ceiling. Jacob crouches next to me, nails digging into my shoulder, and I know something's wrong because I don't just feel his grip. It hurts. His hand is solid on my arm, like flesh and bone. "What happened?" I ask. It comes out a groggy mumble. Jacob helps me sit up. I look down at myself and gasp. I'm washed out, faded like a picture, like Jacob, like every other ghost in the veil. But it's not the lack of color that startles me. It's the lack of light. The glow behind my ribs, that steady blue-white coil, is gone. It all comes rushing back then. The raven in red, her hand reaching through my chest, the bright ribbon wrapped around her fingers. Another memory collides with it, Lara putting her hand to her own chest.
"We've got something they want. If she got a hold of a life like yours, it would be disastrous."
I stagger to my feet, head spinning.
"Where is she?"
The cells to every side are filled with prisoner ghosts, but I barely register any of them as I stumble up the stairs and out into the castle courtyard. The square is full of ghost soldiers carrying bayonets, men in fine cut clothes, women in corseted dresses, but there's no sign of the raven. I reach out to grab the veil, to wrench it aside and plunge back into the world of the living, but my fingers close on nothing but air.
"No, not again."
"Cassidy?" says Jacob, but I have to focus. I close my eyes and try to imagine the gray cloth against my fingers, the curtain brushing my palms, and I catch hold of something, something thin, but there. I open my eyes, let out a shaky breath when I see the veil in my hands, but when I try to pull the fabric aside, I can't. I can't find the part in the curtain, because there is no part. The veil warps around my fingers, bending slightly with the pressure, but no matter how I pull, the curtain doesn't let me through. I throw my weight against the gray cloth, and it stretches, pulls tight, but doesn't break.
No wonder it's so hard for ghosts to touch our world, to leave any kind of mark. But I'm not a ghost. I'm an in-betweener, a betwixter, a veil-crosser. That means I've got a foot on either side. That means I can get back. I have to be able to get back. Jacob's saying something, but I can't hear him, not over the white noise of panic in my ears. And the shock when I see her. She's all the way across the courtyard and on the other side of the veil, but I can see her, clear as glass, as if someone cut a window through the fog. Her red cloak, her black hair, the light of my life coiled around her hand. The raven looks back at me across the veil and smiles, and then she turns and slips through the crowd. I can't let her get away with this. I can't let her get away. But she's already gone, and I'm left banging on the veil as it hardens from curtain to wall against my hands. Jacob's voice finally registers.
I'm so sorry, Cass. I tried to warn you it was a trap. You shouldn't have come after me.
I had to, I say, but the words sound thin even to me. I look down at my hands again. They're not as bright as they should be. Not as colorful. Not as real. No, no, no. The word rattles in my head. I don't know if it's denial or the fact that I'm trapped in the veil like all the other ghosts, and just like them, I can't face the truth. The truth that without that light, without that life, I'm the opposite of living. I'm dead.
No, says Jacob with sudden energy. You are not the opposite of living. You are just temporarily without a life, and those are very different things. You see, one is gone forever, and the other is simply misplaced, so all we have to do is find your life and get it back.
I'm usually the one dragging Jacob away from morbid thoughts, and even if he's trying too hard to make me believe, I'm still relieved he's trying. It gives me something to hold on to. Cassidy? I turn at the sound of my name. It's coming from far away, distorted by the veil, drawn out into something high and thin. But I know that voice. I have always known that voice. Mom. And suddenly my panic turns a different shade. Mom! I call back, but my voice comes out like the opposite of an echo, muted. She'll never hear me. I press myself against the veil, straining to see out of the world of the dead and into the land of the living. It's like shoving your face into a bowl of water. No air, and everything's kind of swimmy.
Cassidy?
It's Dad calling this time. At first, his tone is casual, as if they simply haven't spotted me. As if I've wandered off again, just like before. But every time my parents say my name, their voices get tighter, higher, the worry creeping in. I'm right here, I shout. And all around the courtyard, the old-fashioned men and women turn their heads. But beyond the veil, my parents keep calling my name. I can see them, but they can't see me. I can hear them, but they can't hear me. And suddenly I believe what Lara said about ghosts not being in the veil by choice, about them being trapped. Ghosts don't stay because they want to. They stay because they can't move on. Dad pulls his cell phone from his coat and my heart picks up as I dig for the emergency phone in my pocket. I clutch it until my fingers ache, but I already know it won't work. Dad dials, waits, but the phone in my hand never rings. Findlay appears beside my parents, his Scottish lilt a little more than a whisper through the thickening wall.
I'm sure she hasn't gone far.
He has no idea how right he is.
We'll find her,
he continues. I turn toward Jacob, desperate. You have to get their attention. You have to do something out there. Jacob pales.
Cass, I've never been able to—
Please, I beg. You have to try. Jacob swallows, then gives a determined nod.
Okay,
he says.
Stay here.
As if I have a choice. He reaches out and the veil manifests around his fingers, solid but pliant, bending. For a second, as he presses against the curtain and the fog thins, I can see the world beyond, and I think it's going to work. But then Jacob's hand begins to shake,
and the veil repels him. Jacob stumbles backward and my heart sinks.
I don't understand,
he says, rubbing his fingers. But I think I do. Jacob and I have always been tangled up, tied together. And he's always been able to cross over, but that was when I could, too. He could come into my world and I could go into his. But now that I'm trapped here, so is he. A soldier ghost cuts in front of us, blocking my view. The veil ripples and the world beyond it fades like a dream.
It's no place for children,
growls the soldier, gesturing at the castle yard.
Get your gun or I'll toss you in a prison cell.
My parents' voices are fading. Wait, I say, trying to slip past the soldier. He cuffs me around the collar and shoves me backward into Jacob. We go stumbling onto the cobblestones, the soldier glowering at us. Jacob gets up and pulls me to my feet.
Come on,
he says in my ear.
We can't stay here.
But I can't just leave my parents either. Jacob wraps his arms around me and squeezes.
We're going to figure this out.
His voice is an anchor. His words are a raft. You're right, I say. I have to get my life back. I pull free and start toward the castle gate, forcing myself away from my parents and Findlay and the crew, away from the sound of my name on the air. Jacob doesn't have to ask where we're going. He can read my mind, so he already knows. We're going to get help. Chapter 21. Sometimes help is a place, and sometimes it's a person, and sometimes it's a bit of both. We set out on foot, racing off the castle grounds, through the portcullis and the front gate. We have to get to the lane's end. We have to find Lara. We hurry down the broad set of steps, and it spits us out at the top of the Royal Mile. The other Edinburgh is gone, swept behind the curtain. Here in the Vale, a stranger, older city takes shape, brimming with, well, not life, but movement, people. This is the real city of ghosts. They're everywhere, some in modern dress and others in old-fashioned clothes. As I watch a dozen different scenes play out, it's clear enough that Lara was right. Every ghost is trapped inside their own time, their own loop. Mourners gather under a sea of umbrellas. A woman in a long dress pushes an ornate stroller, cooing to its hidden contents. A cluster of men wearing kilts stumbles past, their accents too thick to understand.
Get back here,
bellows a man, and I turn, thinking he's talking to me, but a second later, a small boy darts past us clutching a loaf of bread. The vendor charges after as the boy races into the street, right out in front of a horse and carriage. I reach to catch his arm, but I'm too late. The boy trips and the horse rears up, and I squeeze my eyes shut, waiting for the crash, the screams, but they don't come. A moment later, the boy and the man and the horse and carriage are gone. Somewhere, the loop begins again.
Come on, Cass, says Jacob, taking my hand.
We turn off the Royal Mile and the world flickers, shifts. It's like moving from room to room in an endless house. There are moments when it seems empty, a blank gray canvas, and others when the ghosts and memories layer so thick it's hard to focus. A woman in vintage clothes storms out of a doorway. Threads of smoke billow up from a building down the street. A man in a hooded cloak warns people to stay inside. I've never been in the Vale this long. Things should be getting murky by now, but instead, they're getting clearer. I don't feel dizzy or foggy or lost or any of the other things that a living person is supposed to feel if they spend too long in the land of the dead. This is a bad sign, and I know it. And so does Jacob, who clutches my hand as we race toward the lane's end. But the closer we get, the more I feel like I'm going the wrong way. Which doesn't make any sense. Turn around, say my legs. Go this way, say my arms. Follow me, says my heart. But I can't trust any of them, not here in the Vale. The lane's end comes into sight,
and a small sob of relief escapes my throat. I'm so glad to see that bright red door. I try not to dwell on what it means, that the Lane's End exists here inside the veil, that someone's last moments must be rooted in this place. I throw open the door.
Laura!
I call into the front hall.
Laura!
Shouts Jacob as we climb the stairs to 1A. She probably can't hear us. Not across the veil, but we call out anyway. The door to her flat hangs open and we step inside. It looks older, stranger, piled with books and wallpaper differently. Of course, this isn't Laura's flat, but right now it's as close as I can get. I have to hope it's close enough. I press myself against the veil, trying to see through a curtain that seems to be getting thicker with every passing second. When the world beyond finally comes into view, it's out of focus, like staring at two strips of film that haven't been lined up quite right. My heart sinks because, blurry or not, I can see that the flat is empty. I should be surprised, but I'm not. I knew she wouldn't be here. I just don't know how I knew.
Hello, hello,
says a low voice behind me. Jacob jumps, and I spin around to find an older man in a robe. He has a pipe between his lips and a book under one arm. He's a ghost, that part's obvious, but there's something about him that also seems solid, present. With the grieving father in the freezing house, it was clear we'd stepped into his memory. Even when he talked to me, he was in a deep fog. But this man doesn't seem to be stuck in a loop. When he looks at me, at Jacob, I can tell he really sees us.
Can I help you?
He asks in a kind voice. I'm looking for Laura, I stammer.
I'm afraid my niece isn't home.
Your niece?
How rude,
says the man holding out his hand.
I'm Reginald Weathershire. My friends call me Reggie.
Of course. Mr. Weathershire. The Lane's End. This must be his veil. Cassidy Blake, I say, shaking his hand. Mr. Weathershire frowns.
She mentioned you, but...
He shakes his head.
She said you were...
He gestures to my shirt front where the light should be.
Like her.
I'm not a ghost, I say, cringing at the word. It's just been a very long day.
Hi, I'm Jacob.
Jacob cuts in.
And not to be rude, but we're kind of in a hurry. Do you know where your niece went?
Mr. Weathershire shakes his head.
Afraid I don't get out much these days.
Panic fills my lungs like water. How am I supposed to find Laura? I turn in a slow circle, trying to figure out what to do. But the veil doesn't have any answers. I close my eyes and force myself to breathe. Focus on the air going into my lungs, the tug inside my chest. Wait, a tug? It's there, right behind my ribs. The same pull I felt when I first met Laura. Like there was a thread running between us. I feel it now, only it's not pulling me into the flat, but out into the hall, down the stairs. We have to go.
Wait, where?
Asks Jacob. I think I know how to find her. I say, already heading for the door. But something makes me look back. Mr. Weathershire is across the room, sliding his book into a gap on his shelf. According to Laura, he's a ghost, and he should be sent on. But he doesn't look lost. He doesn't seem trapped. Why are you here? I ask. He looks around fondly.
Suppose I'm not ready to say goodbye.
And Laura lets you stay? He chuckles softly.
We all need someone who sees us clearly.
Huh. Maybe Laura has a soft spot after all.
And maybe I'm a skull shooter, says Jacob. No offense, Cass, but I don't care about Laura's inner Hufflepuff. I care about getting your life back, and to do that, we need to find her.
Jacob's right, of course. I follow the pull, let it lead me down the stairs and out onto the street. Mom always says to trust your gut, so I do. Have you ever stood at the top of a hill? There's that natural urge to go down,
the way your legs pick up momentum once you start, the pull of gravity sending you always, always, always toward the base of the slope. That's what it feels like now. Like Lara is the bottom of the hill, and I'm being drawn toward her. All I have to do is trust my feet and walk. Chapter 22. I know it sounds crazy, I say, explaining the pull I feel as we make our way through the ghostly city. Jacob shrugs.
It's not the weirdest thing that's happened today.
I laugh, a small, frantic sound. He knocks my shoulder. The veil ebbs and flows around us. Buildings going up and coming down, ghosts flickering past. I should have listened to my limbs when they told me I was going the wrong way. Now I let them lead me. I don't ignore the tug, the voice in my bones that says go this way or that. My feet carry me, and with every step, the line between me and Lara tightens and tightens and tightens until it starts to go slack. I slam to a stop. Thinking I've gone the wrong way, I backtrack several feet until the tension returns. I try again, but no matter where I go from here, the line slackens. This, right here, is where I'm supposed to be. The problem is, right here isn't anywhere. The veil is empty, except for smudges of street and the smoky outlines of places that don't exist on this side of the curtain. It's like one of those paintings where the artist leaves the sketch lines at the edges. This is an edge, a spot where the veil and the regular world don't line up. I squint, trying to make out the other side, but it's getting harder to see anything beyond the curtain. When I try, everything's out of focus, and... focus. That gives me an idea. My camera is still hanging around my neck. It may be a weird camera, one that sees a little less and a little more, but all cameras allow you to adjust for different focal lengths, so you can focus on things that are up close or things that are far away, like the veil and the regular world. I lift the cracked viewfinder to my eye, turning the lens until the veil in front of me blurs. For a second, the whole picture is out of focus, but I keep turning the lens until the veil becomes a haze and the real world beyond comes into sharp relief. If we were in the real world right now, we'd be standing inside a bookstore. Blackwell's, reads a sign on the wall in white and blue paint. Follow me, I tell Jacob. He keeps a hand on my shoulder, and I keep my eye to the viewfinder as we weave through a maze of customers and bookshelves. Down, says the tug in my chest, and I take the stairs, moving through a world I can see but not touch, passing through people as if they're not even there, when really, I'm the one who's missing. We reach the bottom floor, and there she is, in a corner of the bookstore cafe. She's sitting at a small, round table, stirring a cup of tea and reading a book. Lara! I shout, hoping her senses are more tuned than mine. She glances up and my hopes soar for a second before she looks back at her book. Lara, please! A slight crease forms between her eyes, but that's it. I reach out and push her as hard as I can, or at least I try. My hand hits the veil and it feels more like glass than fabric. The glass trembles, but doesn't bend or break. Lara gets to her feet, shuts the book, and starts to leave. No. I follow her out of the cafe, Jacob on my heels.
Lara, 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 Lara,
he calls as she rounds the corner into an empty aisle, promptly spins on one heel, and steps smoothly through the veil.
What?
She hisses. I let my camera fall back on its strap. The bookstore shimmers like the after image of a flash, bright and gone, bright and gone. But Lara is there, real.
So you did hear us, says Jacob.
Yes, I heard you, ghost, she snaps.
My name,
he shoots back,
is Jacob.
I don't have time for any of this. Lara, I say, we have a problem. Her attention finally shifts my way, a smart reply already forming on her lips. But at the sight of me, gray and faded and lightless, She stops. For the first time since we met, Laura looks truly surprised. I didn't think it was possible to faze her, and I'm not sure if it makes me proud or terrified. Cassidy, she murmurs. I thought my current state might merit some concern, but I'm still caught off guard when the next words out of her mouth are, "What have you done?"
I didn't do anything, I counter. I warned you, says Laura, hands on her hips. I told you to stay away from the raven, and you...
She turns on Jacob.
I told you to protect her.
Back to me.
I left you alone for an hour, and you go and lose your thread? You're really not helping,
I say, fighting to keep the panic from my voice.
What were you thinking? She continues. Where was your camera?
I duck my head.
The cap was on.
Laura throws up both hands.
That's just great, Cassidy.
She sighs, pinching the bridge of her nose.
How did you even find me?
I don't know, I say. I just kind of knew, like there was a rope running between us. Laura nods. Her eyes narrow in what I'm coming to recognize is her thinking face.
It makes sense that we'd be drawn together. After all, like calls to like.
I felt it too, but I didn't realize it had a use.
Not to interrupt your brainstorming, says Jacob, but Cass is currently a ghost.
It's the first time I've heard the words out loud. It turns my stomach.
Don't be dramatic, Laura says. You're just stuck in the veil, she tells me. Your life thread has been stolen. We need to steal it back. Tell me exactly what happened.
So I do. I tell her about the castle, the creepy children, the raven in red and the way she stole my life. Laura listens to the whole story in silence, arms crossed and eyes cast upward. She stays that way even after I've finished.
Say something, I plead as an uncomfortable silence settles over us.
I'm thinking.
Think faster,
says Jacob. All of a sudden a shiver rolls through me, and for an instant my lungs ache and the world dims, and I feel so cold I can't imagine ever being warm again.
Cass, says Jacob, his eyes wide with worry. What was that?
I don't know, I whisper, trying to keep the tremble from my voice. But when I look down at my hands, they seem grayer.
You really don't look good, says Laura, which is a totally unhelpful comment. Her own warm light shines brightly through her shirt.
I want my life back, I say through chattering teeth.
Laura bites her lip.
All right. Do you want the good news or the bad?
I could really use some good news right now.
The good news is, the raven doesn't own your life yet. It's still yours. She's just borrowing it.
And the bad news? I ask. Laura hesitates.
The bad news is what she's going to do with it.
I don't even want to ask, but I don't have a choice.
What? Well, says Laura, she has to dig up her own body and put your life inside it. I guess that's another piece of good news. It does take time to dig up a body, so we have until she manages that. But I guess that's also the bad news. Once she places your life thread inside her body, well, there's no untying that knot.
Laura looks down at her watch.
There are 5 historical graveyards in Edinburgh, and it's safe to assume she'll go to one of them.
I'm so caught up in the good news, bad news seesaw that it takes me a moment to remember. I know that answer. Findlay already told me.
She's buried in Greyfriars.
Laura brightens.
Well, that's a step in the right direction. Greyfriars is not far from here. Let's go.
Laura turns, but I catch her arm.
Wait, you can't come with us. You need me there.
And she's right. I know, but I need you to do something else first.
What could possibly be more important?
You have to find my parents.
Laura blanches.
What? They're up at the castle, or at least they were. Look for the filming crew and Findlay, and...
And what exactly am I supposed to tell them?
Snaps Laura.
that their daughter got snatched up by some creepy Scottish legend?
I pause for a